Welcome to the Freedom Trail Podcast, brought to you by the Freedom Trail Foundation and the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Episode 3, James Otis and the Early Days of Revolution, featuring The Madness of James Otis, an audio play performed by the Freedom Trail Players. Also, a statement from Cassius Cash, superintendent of the Boston National Historical Park and the Boston African American Historic Sites, on the new National Park Visitor Center in Faneuil Hall. Part 1, The Madness of James Otis.
On May 23, 1783, James Otis died when he was struck by lightning. It was a strange but somehow fitting end for the most volatile and erratic of Boston's patriot leaders. Reportedly, he had even predicted the event to his sister, Mercy Otis Warren.
My dear sister, I hope when God Almighty, in his righteous providence, shall take me out of time into eternity, that it will be by a flash of lightning.
Despite his spectacular end, and despite being credited with coining the phrase, taxation without representation is tyranny, James Otis is not the household name that his contemporary Whigs, Paul Revere and John Hancock, are. And yet, John Adams' praise of Otis the Patriot was never less than glowing.
I have never known a man whose love of country was more ardent or sincere, never one who suffered so much, never one whose service for any 10 years of his life was so important and essential to the cause of his country as those of Mr. Otis from 1760 to 1770.
If we are to take Adams at his word, it begs the question of why Otis is not better remembered, and the answer lies with the volatility of the man. Incidents throughout his life, which only seemed to worsen over time, have led many to conclude that he suffered from bipolar disorder. One such incident occurred when he was playing violin for a group of young friends.
Oh, come, Jemmy, and play us another! Everyone is up and dancing!
So fiddled Orpheus, and so danced the brutes!
Otis threw aside his violin and dashed into the garden.
Jemmy, wait!
Such fits of rage followed him as he advanced in law and politics. In his 1823 biography of Otis, William Tudor recounted an anecdote that told of a conversation that occurred when Otis first took his seat in the Massachusetts House of Representatives.
Mr. Otis, you have great abilities, but you are too warm, too impetuous.
I beg your pardon?
Your opponents, though they cannot meet you in an argument, will get the advantage by interrupting you and putting you in a passion.
Well, if you see me growing warm, give me a hint, and I'll command myself.
But when Otis was interrupted while speaking and the man gave him a warning tug on his coat, Otis turned and snapped at his benefactor.
Let me alone! Do you take me for a schoolboy?
The same passions that made Otis a great orator and tenacious in debate were often his undoing. It was perhaps the grudge he held over a perceived slight that launched him to his greatest triumph. Governor Shirley had promised Otis' father, James Otis Sr., the position of Chief Justice. When the position came open in 1760, Shirley's successor, Governor Bernard, wasn't inclined to honor his predecessor's commitments and instead named Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson. Otis was enraged at the snubbing of his father, and rumors abounded of his furious reaction.
I shall set the province in flames, though I perish in the fire. Flectere sinequio superos ecuranta movebo.
A Latin phrase which translates as,
if heaven I cannot bend, then hell I'll stir.
Biographers of Otis, such as William Tudor and Jared Sparks, point out that there is no confirmation of Otis speaking these words beyond common report and a rumor recorded in Adams' diary. But it is certainly true that his actions that followed seemed to fulfill the promise of his rumored declaration. The following year, 1761, saw James Otis challenge the crown in the writs of assistance case. Otis had been made Advocate General of the Admiralty Court in 1760, but resigned the prestigious post in the wake of the snubbing of his father. In a dramatic reverse, Otis challenged the court on the legality of writs of assistance, which served as general search warrants that did not expire, allowing customs officials to search anywhere for smuggled goods without having to obtain a specific warrant. Otis represented the merchants pro bono, or free of charge.
I take this opportunity to declare that whether under a fee or not, for in such a cause as this, I despise a fee, I will to my dying day oppose with all the powers and faculties God has given me, all such instruments of slavery on the one hand and villainy on the other, as this writ of assistance is.
On February 23, 1761, James Otis made his opening argument in the case. A young John Adams was there taking notes.
Near the fire were seated five judges, with Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson at their head as Chief Justice, all in their new fresh robes of scarlet English cloth and immense judicial wigs. They were not seated on ivory chairs, but their dress was more solemn and more pompous than that of the Roman Senate.
In his opening statement, Otis made reference to the fact that he had become something of a controversial figure in Boston.
My engaging in this cause has raised much resentment, but I cheerfully submit myself to every odious name for conscience's sake, and from my soul I despise all those whose guilt, malice, or folly has made them my foes. Let the consequences be what they will, I am determined to proceed. The only principles of public conduct that are worthy of a gentleman are to sacrifice estate, ease, health, and applause, and even life to the sacred cause of his country.
As his opening statement continued, the passionate Otis criticized the actions of the royal government and demanded the rights due the colonists as Englishmen.
One of the most essential branches of English liberty is the freedom of one's house. A man's house is his castle, and whilst he is quiet, he is as well guarded as a prince in his castle. This writ, if it should be declared legal, would totally annihilate this privilege. Custom house officers may enter our houses when they please. Their menial servants may enter, may break locks, bars, and everything in their way. And whether they break through malice or revenge, no man, no court can inquire. Bare suspicion without oath is sufficient.
John Adams was bowled over by the eloquence of Otis.
James Otis was a flame of fire, with a profusion of legal authorities, a prophetic glare of his eyes into futurity, and a rapid torrent of impetuous eloquence. He hurried away all before him.
And yet, even in this moment, in which he was at the peak of his powers, Otis could not help but reference his own instability.
This wanton exercise of this power is not a chimerical suggestion of a heated brain. One arbitrary exertion will provoke another until society be involved in tumult and in blood.
For the rest of his life, John Adams would remember that day as the moment it all began.
The seeds of patriots and heroes to defend the vigorous youth were then and there sown. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away as I did, ready to take arms against the writs of assistance. Then and there was the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there, the child independence was born.
James Otis' speech lasted 5 hours. He lost the case, but many feel today, as Adams wrote, that
Mr. Otis's oration against writs of assistance breathed into this nation the breath of life.
And yet, the volatility of the man was such that within a few years' time, Otis was toning down his rhetoric. His father had since received a royal appointment, and the salve for that old wound was apparently enough to tame him. So much so that the May 13, 1765 issue of the Boston Evening Post contained a parody verse fashioned after an old song lampooning the changeable Mr. Otis.
Jemmy's a town meeting man, and Jemmy makes a speech. And Jemmy swears that liberty and liberty he'll preach. And Jemmy's in the caucus, and Jemmy's with the reps. And all who'd rise as Jemmy rose must tread in Jemmy's steps. As Jemmy is an envious dog, and Jemmy is ambitious, and rage and slander, spite and dirt to Jemmy are delicious. So Jemmy railed at upper folks while Jemmy's dad was out. But Jemmy's dad has now a place, so Jemmy's turned about.
Despite James Otis's occasional pangs of loyalty to the king himself, if not the royal government, he was not seen favorably by the king's agents in the colonies. John Adams recorded in his diary a conversation with Judge Peter Oliver, brother to Andrew Oliver, commissioner of the unpopular Stamp Act.
Major Stockbridge informs me that Colonel Ruggles makes a very good speaker. He has behaved to universal approbation. There is one gentleman who has interested himself most infamously, however. He is forever abusing the court. He said, take all the superior judges and every inferior judge in the province and put them all together and they would not make one half of a common lawyer.
That was a distracted speech. It is a pity that gentleman was not better guided. He has many fine talents.
I have known him these 20 years, and I have no opinion of his head or his heart. He will one time say of the lieutenant governor that he'd rather have him than any man he knows, and the next owl will represent him as the greatest tyrant and most despicable creature living. If bedlamism is a talent, he has it in perfection.
By 1768, after the advent of the hated Townshend Acts, royal authority was once more subject to the vitriol of Otis.
The British House of Commons is nothing but a collection of button makers, horse jockey gamesters, pensioners, pimps, and whore masters. Let Britain rescind their measures, or they are lost forever.
Words that drew the following response from the royal governor, Francis Bernard.
I declare it to be the most violent, insolent, abusive, treasonable declamation that perhaps was ever delivered.
After those words, James Otis could no longer straddle the fence. If his customary volatility ever moved him again to think more kindly of royal authority, it mattered not. In the eyes of the crown, he was a high Whig and a son of liberty. An encounter with a customs agent on September 5, 1769, would put an ugly exclamation point on that fact. Otis had been carrying out a war of words in the press with his critics, writing letters to be published in the paper that called his foes superlative blockheads.
Pay no kind of regard to any of the abusive misrepresentations of me or my country that may be transmitted by the said Joseph Harrison or John Robinson or their confederates, for they are no more worthy of credit than those of Sir Francis Bernard or any of his cabal. It is strange those able lawyers, Governor Hutchinson and the commissioners, have not learnt law enough to know that they have no right to scandalize their neighbors. 'Tis strange that Mr. Robinson could not find out if he officially misrepresents me. I have a natural right, if I can get no other satisfaction, to break his head.
Joseph Harrison offered an apology in print. But the response of customs official John Robinson was to purchase a heavy-headed cane. The fiery Otis appeared later that day at the same shop and demanded the shopkeep supply him with the fellow of it. Thus armed, Otis encountered Robinson at the British Coffee House and got straight to the point.
I demand satisfaction of you, sir.
What satisfaction do you expect me to give?
A gentleman's satisfaction.
I am ready to do it.
Then come along with me.
But as Otis turned to take the quarrel outside, Robinson violently tweaked his nose. The two men dueled for a moment with their canes before the onlookers, all allies of Robinson in the Tory coffee house, disarmed Otis and began to beat him.
No! Stop! No, I beg you!
Fortunately for Otis, John Gridley, nephew to Otis's mentor Jeremiah Gridley, was passing by and heard the angry words of Otis and Robinson through an open door. By the time he reached James Otis, he was lying on the floor with three or four clubs over him, Gridley remembered.
Kill him! Knock him down! Knock him over! Knock him over!
Stop! Stop! It's a dirty usage to treat a man in that manner. I will defend you, sir.
I am much obliged to you.
Come away, Mr. Otis. You must have your wounds dressed.
Otis had received a severe gash on his head from the beating. The town was aghast at his injury. His sister, Mercy Otis Warren, wrote to him of her shock at hearing of the incident.
My dear brother, you know not what I have suffered for you within the last 24 hours. I saw you fallen, slain by the hands of merciless men. Your wife a widow, your children orphans, your friends weeping round you, your country in tears for the man who had sacrificed interest, health, peace for the public weal. But my distress was this evening alleviated by hearing that your life is now not despaired of. You have long and painfully struggled to promote the interest of your country. Thousands are thanking you, praying for the preservation of your life. To theirs let me add my most earnest solicitations that when you recover, you will never either give or receive a challenge from any man on this earth. let his rank and character be what it may.
Things were never quite the same for Otis after that. Was his instability worsened by the beating, or did the incident give the Sons of Liberty the excuse they needed to marginalize the always chaotic Otis while pinning the blame on the Tories? Whatever the truth may be, the dismay of his staunchest supporters, John Adams and his sister Mercy, seems very real indeed.
He rambles and wanders like a ship without a rudder.
The future usefulness of this distinguished friend of his country was destroyed. Reason was shaken from its throne.
Otis slowly receded from public life and involvement with the revolution that he had helped set into motion. 2 years after the victory at Yorktown, James Otis was carried off by the flash of lightning he had so blithely predicted. From across the Atlantic in France, John Adams eulogized his fallen idol.
It is with very afflicting sentiments I learn the death of Mr. Otis, my worthy master. Extraordinary in death as in life, he has left a character that will never die whilst the American Revolution remains, whose foundation he laid with an energy and with masterly abilities which no other man possessed.
Perhaps the last word on Otis should go to fellow patriot Thomas Dawes.
Hark! The deep thunders echo round the skies. On wings of flame the eternal errand flies. One chosen charitable bolt is sped, and Otis mingles with the glorious dead.
In a flash of lightning, the spirit of James Otis was liberated from its shattered tenement, leaving only debate over how great the man might have been had he not been consumed by the very passions that made him great.
Part 2, Superintendent Cassius Cash. The Freedom Trail Foundation is excited to report that the National Park Service is opening a new visitor center on the first floor of Boston's historic Faneuil Hall. The following is a statement from Cassius Cash, Superintendent of the Boston National Historical Park and Boston African American National Historic Sites, on the exciting new changes coming to Faneuil Hall and Boston's National Park, which encompasses parts of the Freedom Trail.
Since 1742, Faneuil Hall has been both a vital marketplace and a hub of civic activity in Boston. When Peter Faneuil donated the building to the town of Boston, he indicated that the upper floors were to be used for civic gatherings, that the ground floor was to be a public marketplace, and that the building's use might never be changed. Boston has been faithful to its commitment, and for 270 years, Faneuil Hall has been a home to commerce and free speech. As the center of trade in colonial times, Faneuil Hall would have brought many worlds together. When the doors opened to the new National Park Service Visitor Center on May 25th, Faneuil Hall will continue to honor that mission, preserving the iconic space, engaging all people, and cultivating Boston's most celebrated landmark into a showpiece and center for visitor information. The new visitor center would be much more than an entryway into Boston National Historical Park and Boston African American National Historic Site. It will serve also as a gateway to all Massachusetts national parks. It would be open, light-filled, and welcoming. Visitors will find visual displays, printed materials, maps, and park rangers on hand to provide expert guidance and free tours. The new Faneuil Hall Visitor Center, integrating current technologies and design while remaining faithful to the traditional national park experience that travelers have come to know and love, will give visitors from all over the globe the information they need to make the most of their time in Boston and Massachusetts.
The new Visitor Center at Faneuil Hall will be open to the public on Friday, October 24th, 2012. Part 3, an interview with Nat Shidley, Director of Public History at the Bostonian Society, on the life and rise of James Otis. So today we're discussing James Otis. First though, Nat, if you wouldn't mind explaining, why should we be talking about James Otis at all?
Well, he's a really colorful character, and that is fun in its own right, just as a way of connecting with the story of the American Revolution, but he's also a very important figure in the history. John Adams, looking back on the period of the American Revolution, remembered a case that Otis had argued in the council chamber at the Old State House. It's a famous case, the writs of assistance. It was argued in 1761. And looking back on the argument that Otis made, it was a very extended, lengthy, passionate defense of colonial liberties. He said, then and there, the child liberty was born. Or rather, then and there, the child independence was born. And so Otis was in the very early stages of the American Revolution or of the colonial resistance to British policies. It was a really, really powerful intellectual figure. He helped to shape the language of resistance in the early stages of the conflict.
So why is it that people don't really talk about him that much anymore?
Well, he's a really complicated figure. He's complicated in a range of ways. We remember him sometimes for the fits of madness that he had, and these were something that plagued him through his life, but really came to a head in the later 1760s and especially in 1770. He suffers from a kind of mental instability, which renders some of his involvement in the debates of the day incoherent, but also leads to his being marginalized by the time period that is most frequently pointed to as the origins of the revolution. So by the arguments over the Tea Act and by the arguments over the coercive acts, sort of 1773, 1774, and then by the beginning of armed conflict, he's really been pushed to the margins because he's seen as someone who's very unpredictable and inconsistent in his views. But there's more to it than that. He's also someone who is difficult to get a handle on just from the intellectual content of his arguments. So Bernard Balin, a really important historian of the American Revolution over the last 50 years, in a very important book that he wrote, The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, really wrestled with this and argued that that Otis suffered from trying to maintain simultaneously two irreconcilable positions on the key issues of the day. And there's been a lot of writing about this, and I think it is possible to see a kind of logical coherence to his arguments, but he begins in the early stages of colonial resistance to British policies by espousing a natural rights view, saying that if Parliament passes a law that tramples on the people's natural liberties, that the people have the right to simply disregard that law, to consider it to be void. But he moves away from that position after 1765 and says there is no power greater than Parliament. The people have no recourse if Parliament passes a law that they simply don't agree with. And that's a very complicated thing to come to terms with. The first position we see as a radical Whig position. The second position tends to be associated with loyalists. And Otis maintains his opposition to British policy, continues to be an important figure in the colonial resistance. But here he is embracing something of a view that appears to be closely allied to the loyalists. So he's charged during his own day with being an opportunist. And he's seen as being intellectually bankrupt by later intellectual historians. I think it's not necessarily true, but in all those ways, he's complicated, and so we have a hard time making sense of him, and thereby we often push him aside when we're trying to make clear arguments about what the revolution was all about.
Now, you mentioned that he has positions that sometimes appear Whig, sometimes appear loyalist, and some people would say that makes him kind of inconsistent. Is there any basis to his inconsistency? Is there a reason he goes back and forth, or do you see a consistency between these loyalist and Whig positions?
Yeah, I think the most compelling way to put it together and to understand what holds his views together over the arc of their development is really to think about his commitment to an enduring connection between the colonies and Great Britain. This is a guy he grew up in Barnstable, right? So he's twice over on the margins of empire, right? He's not only from Massachusetts in an empire centered in London, but he's also from Barnstable in a province whose center of gravity is in Boston. So he's had to push really hard to get to the center of affairs. And he's come to think of himself as a cosmopolitan, as someone who is a Briton at heart. And he sees that as compatible and in fact, sort of inseparably part of his provincial identity. So the provinces have meaning as part of the empire. He doesn't really imagine a world in which the colonies become independent. And he writes about this in his private correspondence, that this is a step we hope to avoid, right? If Britain, he's warning folks in London, if Parliament continues down this path, that which we hope will be pushed off indefinitely will arrive a lot sooner than we want, namely independence. And he's trying to avoid that. Now, one way to avoid that when Parliament passes a law that is that angers colonists is to try to persuade Parliament to repeal that law. And so I think what he's doing is, in a pragmatic way, trying multiple different ways of making the arguments that will put the empire back on sound footing, trying to roll back some of the most abrasive policies that are coming out of London.
And at the same time, you end up with people like you say, like John Adams, who believes this man created independence, and at the same time, he's working to stop it.
Right. I know it's a great irony. I think it's a vision that Adams sees in retrospect. Certainly, Otis's actions helped to put the colonies on the path to independence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what Otis sought at the outset. But he did seek to defend the rights of the colonies as he understood them.
Now, James Otis, as you mentioned, is a early proponent of American patriot ideas. How did he get to that point in his political career? What's his background that leads him to where he is?
Yeah, okay. So the Otis family is actually a really interesting family. He was the fifth generation of Otises in Massachusetts, or actually they had originally been in Plymouth, in the Plymouth colony. So the family was of really modest means when they came over in the 17th century. And so it was a family of strivers trying to make their way up in the world. Otis's father was a merchant and a lawyer who had managed to win himself a seat in the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and then aspired to greater things, sought very hard to be appointed to the highest court in the province, and was frustrated in that, and then worked to be elected by the House to serve on the governor's council. He was successful in that regard.
Now, you mentioned briefly the writs of assistance case and James Otis's argument in it. Could you just go into that particular case a little bit more? I know it happened in what is now the museum the Bostonian Society runs. So
that's right. Actually, if you go to the current State House, to the Bulfinch State House up on Beacon Hill, you'll see a big mural in the central rotunda depicting the argument, and it's painted very much from John Adams' recollection of this. So Adams was a few years Otis's junior, and he was there that day, breathlessly taking notes and trying to learn from the way in which this master of the lawyer's craft approached the challenge of the argument. So it was a sort of gathering of who's who at the time. And as I've said, the particular issue surrounded the writ of assistance, which was an instrument that was, I think, contentious in many ways and had caused a little bit of friction previously in the colonies, but hadn't been carefully scrutinized and had its roots back in English practice. The particular question here was whether or not the highest court in Massachusetts could authorize writs of assistance, or if the law that provided for these applied only to England, to the realm itself, did it apply, did it extend into the colonies? Most of the lawyers who were in the room that day confined their arguments to that narrow legal issue. And what Otis did was he essentially bracketed that and painted a broad historical picture and argued that this particular instrument belonged to a much longer tradition of of conflict between those reaching for absolute power and those trying to protect the people's liberties. So he puts it in the context of the 17th century struggles within England over the absolute monarchy and trying to limit the monarchy. Now, all this had been resolved. First, there had been the hiccup, a lot more than a hiccup, but when Charles had been removed by the Puritan Parliament. And then after the Restoration, the Tudor monarchs had tried to accumulate authority in their hands again, or at least this is the portrait that is painted by Whigs at the time, and had finally had a conflict with Parliament over this, and the question had been resolved by the Glorious Revolution of 1689, and the resolution was that Parliament had authority and the power of the monarch had been limited. So what Otis does is he says this is part of this age-old issue in which there's always some creep, and if not carefully attended to, the people's liberties are lost. This is, he calls it a holdover from the Star Chamber, which was part of those 17th century arguments. But the basic point here is that he's reaching back to his knowledge of English history, and he's trying to put this in the context of something that matters far beyond the narrow legal issue of the writ of assistance. And it's breathtaking. It's not an argument that had been coherently assembled in the colonies in this way at that time, but it is going to be the historical frame now that will inform much of the argument over the British taxes that come out during the 1760s and into the 1770s. So it really helps to shape the debate that follows.
You mentioned James Otis's legacy sort of ending early as a result of what you mentioned, what you called fits of madness.
Right.
When does that start, and how bad does it get?
Well, you know, all of this is filtered a little bit through the lens of memory, right? We have the best sources for Otis's life are biographies that are written in the early 19th century, and much of the research on those came through letters written to people who knew Otis and were looking back through the lens of his last years and wondering when it had first started to manifest itself. But most of the biographers agree that he was given to fits of emotion and to little peaks of anger already in the early 1760s. People begin to wonder by the later 1760s if maybe he's lost it. But it's really in 1769 and 1770 when he seems to have had very public fits of madness. So you find people writing about, you know, how he had a peak. And one night in 1770, he systematically throws rocks through all of the windows of the townhouse of what's now the old state house, systematically going through and trashing all of those. There's some suspicion that it may have a little bit to do with drinking too much. So people become concerned that when he gets drunk, he loses control of his emotions and loses control of his wits. It's not entirely clear how much of that is accurate and how much is just misremembering. But by the early 1770s, he's now spending some time out of the public eye, confined essentially in his brother's home or in his father's home, so that until he gets himself back together. And then he returns to public view, he becomes active in the affairs of the day, and then he has another breakdown and he'll disappear again. By the time that his father writes his will, I think the will is dated 1774, he's clearly making provision he's clearly thinking about his son's madness as it relates to the disposition of his estate, right? He doesn't want to put all of the money in the hands of someone who's unstable, so he gives an annuity. He provides an annuity to go to James Otis, and he then also provides that Otis's brothers will, once Otis himself passes on, will confer a gift onto James Otis's son. So in other words, the grandson will get the money, but they're going to skip the father because they don't trust him to take good care of the money anymore. So by the mid-1770s, the family is highly aware of the fact that he's become unstable. And by the time of the war itself, he's now seen as a kind of wandering lunatic. He'll appear out of the blue, all, you know, dirty and scruffy around the edges, ranting about odd things. No one really knows what to do with him. His last appearance in Boston, I believe, comes he comes to pay a visit to his old friend John Hancock, who was then the governor, and is escorted out of the governor's office in the townhouse, in the now the state house, by two sheriff's deputies. And he's not just taken out of the townhouse. They take him to the ferry. They take him across. They see him safely into Andover, you know, brush their hands. We're done. We don't want to see him anymore. By the end of his life, he's essentially confined to bed. He's spending a lot of time reading and quietly attending to private matters.
Now, there's a story that's incredibly popular out on the trail, and a lot of folks don't believe it to be true, and the tourists tend to be shocked when they hear it. They think that the guides are lying, so I just want to ask you about it, because I want your opinion on it. James Otis gets hit in the head with a club. How does that happen? Is it real? Did it happen?
Yeah, there was a famous fight at one of the taverns on King Street. There's a lot of personal animosity that surrounds the political arguments of the day. Everyone knows each other. They get angry when they feel like their words are being misrepresented. And there's this famous fight that happens in one of the taverns where Otis hears that someone is there. He's really angry with him because he hears he's been described in a very uncharitable way. And he goes in, and essentially dueling had been prohibited in Boston for a long time. So he can't challenge him to a duel, but he says that he intends to fight him. And they stand up. His nose is tweaked. There's, you know, fisticuffs, and he gets whacked on the head with a cane. And some people, it was a popular story in the Whig movement at the day. Those who were sort of former allies of Otis and who were somewhat embarrassed by the fact that he had lost his wits, they argue that it was the consequence of the Loyalists. The Tories had engineered this physical assault on him, had seen to it that he had been delivered such a heavy blow on his head that it essentially ruined his mind. And that explains his descent into madness. So it becomes, the personal story becomes part of the political story too.
But you would argue that it was probably before that?
Well, the fight clearly happens. We have enough evidence to know that there was a physical altercation. But I think the evidence that is the root cause of his mental instability is very thin. There's enough evidence that it was present far earlier.
So we began this interview by discussing how James Otis kind of isn't talked about today. And while he himself isn't brought up a lot, is there a legacy of his work that we still see when we study the American Revolution as a movement?
I mean, I think the legacy of his work is really in the ideas in many ways. I think that, you know, his early writings, I mean, he writes a very popular pamphlet that appears in 1764. It's really one of the first written defenses of the liberties of the colonists that helped to shape subsequent defenses. He's one of the first to respond to what appears to be a new direction in imperial administration, and the way in which he shapes the argument, framing it as not just an issue of narrow questions of administration, but as part of a broader argument about liberty and about the liberties of the colonists and how they ought to be defended. That's something that shapes in many ways the way in which subsequent Whig arguments are crafted. But more than that, I mean, I think you can argue that I think you can argue that his his role, so he was the author, we believe, the author of the circular letter that the Massachusetts House of Representatives sent out after the Townsend duties in 1768 to encourage all of the other colonies to work together in order to resist British policies. This was a very important step. First, a vision of the colonies having a common interest and working together in order to defend it, something that he had already been promoting in a few years earlier when he encouraged the colonies to meet together in a Stamp Act Congress in order to resist the Stamp Act. But here, the House of Representatives is endorsing this view and is officially encouraging other assemblies in other colonies to work together and to inform each other of what's going on so that they can be sure to stop the encroachment upon their liberties. London requires Governor Barnard to have the Assembly rescind that letter, and the Assembly famously votes not to do so. And it's seen as a heroic act because they know they're going to be prorogued, they're going to be dissolved as a result of this. They are resolved. It really helps to bring to a head animosity at that moment in 1768, and it's in many ways responsible for the chain of events that brings British troops to Boston later in 1768, which I think you can argue is really the turning point, the tipping point in the revolution, because at that point, once Boston is occupied by British troops, it's really impossible to contain the friction that naturally falls from that. And lo and behold, very predictably, you have an incident in March of 1770, the Boston Massacre, which leads to a real rupture in any potential for reconciliation between the colonies and Britain. So Otis is there, at the root of this important chain of events. So I think there's a legacy, a very concrete legacy for his actions.
As you work at the Old State House with the Bostonian Society, I don't want to ignore the James Otis Old State House connection. So if you wouldn't mind just taking a moment to talk about the connections that James Otis has with the Old State House that we haven't covered and what's there today. What can people learn about James Otis at the Old State House today?
He's sort of our mascot at the Old State House. He's such an important figure for us. We love the story about the Writs of Assistance trial and the idea that the child independence was born at that moment, and Otis there declaiming, the gifted orator. It's a vision that we include in all of the tours that we offer to visitors on the site. But he also was a real master of house politics at the time. He became Speaker of the House. One of our really important stories is that in 1766, the Massachusetts House decides to build a gallery, a public viewing gallery, so that it's not open to everyone, but certain members of the public are going to be invited in to listen to the debates within the House of Representatives. And that's Otis's idea. It's very clearly documented in the House records that Otis proposes this and is part of the committee that investigates how it's going to be done. It's pretty clear that it's an effort to bring real public pressure on moderates, I think especially from the countryside. Most of the Boston representatives are really radical and already outspoken advocates for colonial liberties, but there are moderates there who have to be influenced. And the idea is not that people are going to be screaming from the galleries, but rather that everything that is said is going to be subject to public scrutiny, because those people are going to go out and they're going to talk to the newspapers and they're going to talk in the taverns. And soon, if you say the wrong sort of thing in what used to be a private debate, you're going to be reviled. So we love the story of the gallery. It's a really important story in the history of our building. So that's there. We always talk about Otis in that connection as well. And then, of course, there's the throwing of the bricks through the windows. So it's part of what you get when you come to the Old State House right now.
Great, and everybody should. It's a wonderful museum. Thanks so much for your time, Nat.
Thank you.
Learn more about Nat Shidley's work at the Bostonian Society by visiting bostonhistory.org, or just pop in the Old State House. Thank you for listening to the Freedom Trail podcast. Generous funding was provided by the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Learn more at massteachers.org. The Madness of James Otis was performed by Sam Jones, John Overby, Melissa Walker, Michael Costello, and Nate Gundy. Our guests were Nat Shidley of the Bostonian Society and Cassius Cash of the National Park Service. Music was provided by Middlesex County Fifes and Drums and Poor Richard's Penny. This podcast was created by the Freedom Trail Foundation and was produced and hosted by me, Matt Wilding. Visit us online at thefreedomtrail.org. Become a fan of the Freedom Trail Foundation on Facebook or Google+, and follow us at The Freedom Trail on Twitter. My apologies for any technical errors. The media department, The Freedom Trail, is one guy. Next episode, we tackle the Battle of Bunker Hill.